Hello, and welcome to Live Like the World is Dying, your podcast for what feels like the end times. I'm your host, Margaret Kiljoy, and this is part two of a conversation with Dean Spade. So you should probably listen to part one, but I'm not your boss. This podcast is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another show on the network. Da-da-da-da!
I'm going to make those pompous academics regret kicking out such a genius. Deciding to build my lab and do my research.
The Time Talks Podcast.
Have you ever stared at a 500-page book and wish you could just talk to the author about their ideas instead? If so, the Time Talks Podcast, part of the Channel Zero Network, is for you, where we discuss history, politics, music, and art with an anti-authoritarian and anarchist perspective.
The Time Talks Podcast.
What's this light? I feel different.
The Time Talks Podcast.
Okay, I have a kind of final-ish question, I think. And it can be ish on the final part, but at the beginning of this, you said that your politics has been moving towards anti-statism or, you know, possibly anarchism or whatever. And I'm wondering if you want to talk about that. In some ways, I feel like you've implied a lot of maybe what has drawn you more towards those politics. But I'm really curious the kind of route you took, or not like where you've landed and what labels you want to throw on things, but what has led you towards those politics.
Yeah, I just had a conversation with somebody yesterday who I know from like the anti-Zionist Jewish world, who was talking about how he feels like people haven't thought, that he hasn't thought a lot about like anti-state or anarchist politics. And he was like, why do you think some people have and some people haven't? And I was like, oh, I think people like just come to our politics, like we kind of stumble into them. It's like if somebody stumbled into a punk mm-hmm. scene in 1999, they probably found anarchism sooner than me. I stumbled into all this queer anti-police stuff, and we were doing a lot of like identity-based work, and people weren't talking about political tendencies in the same way, in part also because it had been really mm-hmm. divisive at certain points in our movements, or people had gotten so obsessed with their ideology that they'd been unable to work together and got really insular. So there was a lot of like, I think, push away for some people from that. Mm-hmm. I think also we have lived in times for the last at least 100 years that are so deeply reactive anti-anarchist, in particular because of the history mm-hmm. of anarchism in the US and elsewhere, there's a really great piece by William C. Anderson that came out a while, like not that long ago, after the Atlanta indictment, about how like policing in the United States itself developed through policing anarchism, that I highly recommend. So I think a lot of us also just like haven't gotten, like it's like, you know, you were told anarchists are just people who want chaos and who are like dirty white people or whatever. There's a lot of like things that erase the contributions of anti-colonial anarchists and anarchists who aren't white and all these things. Or anti-state tendencies that aren't anarchism in the European sense, et cetera. But for me, I think what happened is like, I've been in movements that have been benefiting from a range of genealogies, including like women of color feminism, specifically Black feminism, and other political knowledges and methods that have been anti-institutional in really great ways, had critiques mm-hmm. of the borders and the cops and the military, have also had a focus on practices of collectivity and horizontality with us, you know, mm-hmm. inside our movements, which are very, you know, that really parallel with a lot of anarchist methodologies, like let's not have a boss in this group, you know? And so all of those things really dovetailed with anarchism, but I wasn't ever studying like anarchism itself. Some people who were in groups I was in maybe identified as anarchists, but it didn't seem like an essential thing for me to study for like a number of years. And I didn't think a lot about whether or not that was my position, because also I just like had the same caricatures in my mind that other people did. And I also was like, do anarchists think that like people shouldn't get welfare? I don't know. I had like some of my own, you know, somebody who grew up on welfare, I had some questions about that that I didn't have resolutions to.
Right.
And then over time, especially doing abolitionist work, it just was so clear to me more and more, not only that everything I was already doing dovetailed with anarchism, my interest in mutual aid, my interest in horizontal tactics and inside our groups and in building group culture where we learn how to share and with each other and not boss each other around and all of that stuff. But also the ways in which, like, I think abolitionist frameworks just like, they're so deeply anti-state. It's like, don't build a better cop. Yeah. Don't build a better jail. Don't build a better prison.
Yeah.
Don't build a better social services framework that's actually still a cop, or, you know, and that you can't have a country without cops, borders, and military. That's what a country is made of, you know? And you can't have a capitalist economy without the boot on everybody's neck making us participate in it. So I just came to realize, like, oh yeah, I'm not only against the United States, settler colonial slavery project, but I was like, oh my God, I'm against countries. I'm against that. And then I started actually reading about this stuff. And I was like, oh my God, they're a recent invention. They don't need to be the way people organize themselves. That's not how people have always organized themselves. And I also started to see how it actually makes a difference in our tactics about what we're going to do today if we know this about ourselves or not, like how we're going to get basically co-opted by projects of, oh, let's do a million like local elections, try to take over our city council thing. A lot of that work, which steals the oxygen out of local movements really intensely, like, you know, and I'm not going to say it should never, ever be done, but I just feel like so much of it actually has like a lack of a conversation about what can happen in those spaces behind it, and then is incredibly resource intensive and doesn't lead to the things I think people hope it will lead to, like, oh, we're going to have an abolitionist prosecutor, an abolitionist city council mayor, or city council person or mayor, and it's going to change everything. Right. I'm not seeing that happen. I think we've seen that played out. I think this is even sharpened for me with the period of the defund work, which I care a lot about, trying to defund the police, and seeing the fights inside city councils and how deeply impenetrable. Like, even when you supposedly in 2020 get the whole city council saying we want to defund the police and the whole, you know, there's so much effort on that side. It's like our cities are run by real estate developers and chambers of commerce and police departments. And the entire apparatus of the city council is, which is in some ways more accessible than any other level of government, of course, is still like unmovable. Like you can be right all day long. You can do every kind of research. You can turn up with all the people every single time. And like, as soon as they can turn around and reestablish in their nonstop march to constantly increase the police budget, that's what they'll do. And that is what they have done since 2020 after all this amazing work by so many people. So just like, I think I'm just, you know, continually evaluating like, wow, where are there still parts of my own approach to politics that are assuming we can convince governments of things, even if I, you know, even while I want to get rid of those kinds of governance, like, and why do I ever think they will voluntarily put down their weapons? Like, and why do I think getting any different people inside that machine? I don't believe that about the military. I'm not like, well, maybe if Margaret Killjoy was the general, it would all be really, like, I know that's not true. So why do I, where have I still, and I, you know, I forgive myself and all of us, we're all just trying shit our whole lives. And like, there's many things I've been involved in that I think were like not that generative, but I, you know, couldn't have known that, or where there was a backlash so that the thing that was generative for a while stopped, you know, was turned on us in a way that, undermined our hopes. But I think that for me, it's just like an ongoing deepening with different anti-state frameworks, an ongoing deepening of reading history and understanding why different revolutionary projects that then took on state forms became authoritarian. Trying to understand what this kind of insight, which is very hard because it's about letting go of a lot of hope in a lot of tactics that people are putting a lot of effort into, like what it directs us to do to most immediately support people's well-being and take down the apparatuses that are hurting us that are honestly just like continuing to grow. Like they're all like the level of surveillance we are under right now compared to 5 years ago, the capacity for political repression that the state has right now compared to 5 years ago. I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but like maybe it was this week, like Georgia is going to outlaw bail funds, is going to criminalize bail funds. Tennessee is trying to do the same thing. Like the tiny things we have in our movements to try to support people facing repression, even those they are like directly going after. So like, so it's really hard to face these conditions. And also I see a lot of people working really hard on the ground, blaming themselves for the effects of the conditions. Like, oh, why can't we do a better job stopping these homeless sweeps in our city? Well, it's like, it's not because you're not doing a really good job trying. There's like a lot of really bad conditions. And I think that kind of, it goes back to this humility, like, okay, wow, things are so dire. What if I let myself know this so that I could talk with my friends about what's possible given how things actually are and let go of some of the fantasies. I think I talked to you about briefly before we started the podcast, but I recently rewatched those two videos that Naomi Klein and Molly Crabapple both of whom I really, really respect, made a mm-hmm. few years back. They're both videos about like what the world could be like after like the Green New Deal and after like many wonderful yep. uprisings. And they feel so, so misleading to me. Watching them right now, like they imagine a world in which people just protest a lot and then everyone has things that are better. And also like we still have countries and jobs. It's very weirdly doesn't get rid of capitalism or the nation state, but it's like, there's a kind of like I think that it's very dangerous. Those fantasies that,
yeah.
that we can do certain kinds of tactics and that it'll just like our opponents will just turn over. And I think those are inside a lot of people, a lot of very wise people's messages. And I just increasingly like when I encounter them feel much more concerned about the what they yeah. teach us and what how they mislead us.
I just think that we have to always look clear-headedly at what our actual threats are, at what's actually happening, and then make our decisions based on how to actually address that rather than being like, I want to become just like this person I read about in history, so I'm going to do whatever they did. And this could be yeah. true of like, I want to be a principled pacifist and get arrested just like Gandhi or whatever, right? Yeah. You know, it could also be, I want to be just like the following anarchist in the 1880s who decided it was time to start shooting people. You know, we just need to actually look at what's happening and make our decisions based on that. And it's hard because what we're facing is different than what anyone else has ever faced in history. Not necessarily worse, although if you're the overall ecosystem, it's worse than anything minus like whenever all the, you know, before humans evolved and various other mass die-offs that have happened or whatever. But like, it's different and it's bad. And we just need to look at it and then come up with solutions. Or even some of them are like, how do we solve this problem? And some of it is like, how do we live with this? Not like accept it, but like, except that it's going to have consequences on us and that fighting it isn't going to be easy and we might not win, but what are the best tools by which we can fight it, and or what are the best tools that we can use to live meaningful lives in the process, you know, so that when we inevitably die at 103 or at 33, we can be proud of who we were, you know, and obviously there's like theological or metaphysical considerations into exactly what that process looks like that'll be different for different people. But, you know, I think
it's also like about not trying to feel better. I think there's just something mm-hmm. so intense about people are like, you know, if you talk about collapse, it makes me feel bad. And there's an assumption that that will demobilize me. And it's like, actually capitalism yeah. is like either feel bad or feel good, you know? And
yeah,
that's not how life is. Like, life is like, fuck this, you know, like, for example, you have a terrible loss and you live with grief and you also still enjoy this beautiful meal and you're still grieving and you're in pain. And like, it's just like,
yeah.
it's like being willing and, or your people are really, you know, I see this a lot with my students. They're like, oh my God, the things I'm learning in your class, I'm so worried about these terrible things in the world that I didn't know were going on. This is so awful. And they want to instantly know what to do to feel better. And I'm like,
yeah.
I don't want you to do things to feel better. I want you to do things to try to be part of something, and you'll never know if they worked or not because that's the nature
yeah.
of like, we don't know or what our opposition's next counter move is or whether we'll regret some parts of it. But like, we just, it's the trying stuff. It's the listening to feedback about what didn't go well or how it hurt somebody else. It's like the goal is like connection and belonging with each other and experimentation and, you know, it doesn't always feel good to receive negative feedback, but often it's like incredibly growthful. Like, it's like feeling good
yeah.
can't be the goal. Feeling, yes, and sometimes feeling good and pursuing pleasure, absolutely, but not like I want to have a pat happiness where I don't have to worry or be concerned or be critical. Like, of course, nobody who sees themselves as like radical should be wanting that, but I still think that craving, when it comes to conversations about collapse, where it's like, I want the one thing that make me feel better. Or people feel that about Gaza. Like, oh my God, I just found this horrible genocide's happening. I've not known about this before. I want to be able to go to one action, feel like I did something and be better and post it on Instagram. And it's like,
yeah.
A, love them for waking up to what's happening in Gaza. Love any moment where people become more interested in the well-being of all people and stopping violence. Yeah. And we have to like be willing to to take in how overwhelming this is, how unmovable the war machine feels, and still take action against it, but not because we are like guaranteed that what we did today works or something. You know what I mean? Like that feels, that simplicity really cheats us of like the really complex position we're actually in, that that if we can let ourselves be in it, might allow discernment towards better action, hopefully, you know.
No, and I like how you tied that to the way that capitalism makes us think that happiness is the goal. Like, I like happiness, but my goal of life is not specifically to lead a happy life. It's to have a meaningful life and to have a as complete of a life as, I mean, every life is complete. And, you know, when you look at anyone who's ever known a child who's died has had to come to terms with the fact that every life is complete, you know, as a thing that I've been dealing with because of some stuff. And, you know, yeah, the idea that you're just supposed to be happy is like some fucking McDonald's shit, you know, like, and don't get me wrong, seek happiness, do it. It's great, you know, but yeah, like, no, it sometimes you just need to accept, like, I want to live a beautiful life. And I think that is a different thing, you know? And maybe because I'm like a goth or whatever, I find a lot of different things beautiful than some other people, but, no, I like that. And it does, it helps get people beyond the like, oh good, I can sleep at night because I went to one protest, you know, and instead like learning to sit with the discomfort of all of these things happening and understanding where we do and don't have agency. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, people should be going to these protests.
Yeah.
You know, if nothing else, there are good ways to find the other people who care.
Yeah, meet other people and try stuff. I mean, I want to live in reality. I want to know that I want to, if I've been working on a strategy for 10 years and it has actually not been helping and it's been hurting people, I want to know. I don't want to keep doing it just because my ego is attached to it or my paycheck or, you know, like I've seen that a lot in the dilemmas with the
reform
movements, you know, or I want to, And I absolutely, like, I'm like, I feel like, be promiscuous about the stuff you try. Like, go to all the protests, go to anything, you know, like try anything. But that it's like that willingness to keep open the possibility that I'm going to get feedback or learn that, learn the impacts or learn my position in the world or learn how the clothes I'm wearing impact people who made them or what. I just want to be in reality. That includes the reality of like how unbearably beautiful being alive is, how the entire, like my entire body was structured to receive pleasure from this incredible landscape, like that reality too, which capitalism also shuts down and tells me to only be entertained by video games and chips or whatever, you know, like I want to live fully in the reality of how beautiful and abundant and gorgeous this life is and how heartbreaking and devastating these systems are and how little control I have over them. And then the moments when I do feel connection or am of service to something in my community, like how that is, like all of that, you know, like, but not like through the filter of liberalism that's just like, I need to find out that I'm a good person, TM, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so in that vein, to bring it back to kind of some of the preparedness stuff that you've been writing more about and engaging with more, I was wondering if you want to talk about, like, what is preparedness looking like for you right now? Or, you know, how is it affecting, in as much as you feel like talking about anything personal, like how is it affecting the kind of decisions that you're making about how you want to live or how you prepare?
That's such a good question. I mean, I in general, my study of collapse is affecting a lot of things for me. I'm thinking a lot about the ethics of the fact that I travel on planes and how to reduce that or eliminate it. And also I don't want to get stuck somewhere really far away from my people when things are bad. So I've been thinking a lot about shifting and changes around that. I've been thinking a lot about like how much I want to work a job, what are the other options? You know what I mean? Just like when will I know that I don't want to do that or whatever. I've been writing a book for 10 years. That's kind of like a relationships self-help book for radicals, you know, kind of thing, because I've spent so much time in our movements watching people, you know, tear each other and our groups apart with our own, like, unexamined relational patterns that are very, you know, they're patterned across the culture. So I've been writing a book about that. And then, like, part of me is like, at this point, I just need to recognize I'm writing this for pleasure. Like, I don't know that there's time for this to be of any use to anyone. Like, you know what I mean? Just so, like, that's an interesting move to shift from thinking, you know, probably totally ridiculous fantasy any of us have when we write anything, people will read this and it will help them do something, and being like, right, or not, you know, like, or I'm just
right,
really working on a book for 10 years just for my, because that's what I did with those 10 years of my life. Okay. Like, just that's an interesting move to like let go of outcomes even more than ever. I don't think I've ever thought that I would have like been terribly much impact, but just like even a little hope of that.
I think a lot about just to gas you up really quick. I've seen your cultural impact for years now, and it's always been positive. So I appreciate it. But please continue. Yeah.
I mean, I think about whether I want to live in the country, whether like the cities will be the hardest places to be. And I have friends who have moved to rural places and like really cultivated deep relationships with people, even across political differences and the places they're living. And I'm like, huh. And then I think really some really, you know, detailed specific things, like if I'm going to live in the country in the Pacific Northwest where I live, how can I live less near all of the like scariest, you know, right-wing neo-Nazis, and closer instead to some of the rural people who are a little more like fruits and nuts, you know? So I asked myself that question. I think about what that would look like, you know, what kind of off-grid, you know, I'm not like somebody who can like, you know, buy a vacation house or something. So like, what kind of like off-grid small sort of thing can I do with anybody I know who already has a land project? I think about that. I've been thinking a lot about, I think maybe I've mentioned this to you, I've been thinking a lot about like doing something like go bag parties, even like in subcultural scenes in my own town, doing things to get more people to talk about disaster and collapse, you know, and if they want to think about it as earthquake go bag, awesome. That's a danger in Seattle for sure. If they want to think about, you know, like having people just, and I was thinking about like, how do you make those parties fun? Like, you know, having there be giveaways, having there be like, having people bring, you know, is it also a clothing exchange? Like, just like, is it a sex toy exchange? Like, I've been just imagining different, you know, what would that look like if I did it for my queer friends versus what would it look like if I did it in my block versus what would it look like if I did it with my students? Like, just kind of what would help different people try it, and then also think they could put one on, you know, like just like how to really, especially because I feel like this podcast is, very user-friendly in that way. So like, I've been really inspired by some of your episodes to think about kind of like, what are the ways I could take what I love about mutual aid organizing, and I love like meeting people, and I love like making an event happen, making it welcoming, and having people make new friends. Like, how can that be oriented towards people thinking about preparedness? And kind of how much, you know, some of the questions I've asked myself are like, how much would there be like any talking in program at such an event, or how much would it just be like, come and grab the stuff and here's some printouts of things you could have in your go bag, and here's a pile of bags, and here's a pile of, you know, emergency blankets, and here's a pile of, you know, whatever. I've had those kinds of questions about how to do, I think that's what's next for me, is like to actually try on some of that organizing with some people I know who are interested in that.
When you do that, can you come back on and talk about how it went? I feel like the people will learn from that a lot.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I'd love to, if other people have tried it, I'm curious, please reach out to me. I'm curious to hear their experiences.
Me and one of my friends who does this kind of work too, we put on a day of preparedness. We did a, you know, where you get, there was a bunch of different talks by different people who like lived in that area who came and they talked about the projects they're working on. It was like someone who was like, oh, I'm really into mesh networks. And someone else is like, oh, I'm doing like water collection and rainwater and things like that. And there was like multiple, there was like, I think total of maybe about 6 events at, so you could pick between 2 at any given point, like the way that conferences work or whatever. And there was, you know, a local food distro did lunch that was free for everyone, but then, and then dinner was a giant potluck, and I've actually never seen a giant potluck work so well as the one that I went to. It was cool. And then there was like a big talk that was everyone, and it was more in the evening, and some people only came for that. And it was, you know, we used me as sort of a keynote-ish person, but then it was immediately from there, it was a facilitated roundtable of the people who live in that town talking about their needs and how to meet them. And I'm now thinking, maybe I talked about this before on the show. I have no idea. And then at the very end, we did a making a long-term food bucket, like a, you know, Mylar bags, rice and beans thing, which is way easier to do if you buy it all in bulk. And then it was kind of fun. And there was, my favorite part about it was that theoretically I was organizing it and I know how to make the bucket, but I don't know how to like necessarily like make the 15 people figure out how to make sure that all the food goes evenly to these different buckets or whatever. And people were like, how do we do that? And I was like, figure it out. I don't know. And then everyone self-organized it and it worked perfectly fine. And then like everyone felt more invested because everyone was in charge and figuring things out together. And it was like a nice little microcosm of those, those nice moments in so many ways. And, you know, and then it was, I would say a good third of the people didn't have any money and so didn't pay for their buckets. And a good third of the people were like, I can easily pay twice as much as what this bucket cost, you know, because those buckets are, if you make your own, they're only like $20. If you buy them at a prepper store, if you buy them at a reasonable prepper store, they're $50. If you buy them from like Alex Jones and all that shit, then they're not very good. And they're like way more than that. Hmm. And so that worked, that model worked really well and we're hoping to replicate it. And so, but I really like the way that you're talking about it. I really like the idea of like, yeah, how would it be different? How would the go back party be different for your block versus your students versus your like queer friend group? That I'm fascinated. I want to hear how it goes.
Yeah, I love what you said about people like having to figure things out. I noticed this a lot when we had that police free zone in Seattle during the 2020 uprising, how much people who showed up who'd never done anything political in their lives, they'd never, ever, ever. And they like came to like, I'm coming to the movement. And they arrived at the field in Cal Anderson Park and they wanted something to do. You know, they wanted to do part of an art build or they like people don't want to just sit and watch, you know? And then once you are a part of doing something, you help them move a barricade, whatever, then you're like, it's like transformative about like, I was there and I was part of it and I was important to it. Or it's like, it lets you have it be it's your identity instead of I went and watched the movement, you know, whatever it is. I just, that moment, what you said, agency is the word you used earlier. You know, I feel like that that can happen anywhere, but part of the way it happens is not like overly babying, you know, everybody, you know, like, yes, making things accessible and trying to make it really welcoming, but also like putting people to work if they're up for it, helping coordinate, you know?
Yeah. This goes full circle to something we were talking about at the beginning. We were talking about how do we talk about disaster with people, right? And the words that I wrote down in my like notes that I take while I'm interviewing people is I wrote down disaster fatigue because that's the way that I think about it. You know, the way that a long time ago, I did forest defense and I would go sit in trees and fight against clear cutting and stuff like that. But I actually avoided going to West Virginia and fighting mountaintop removal for a long time, even though I knew it was happening, because it was too much problem. A clear cut is something that is a horrible crisis and you can wrap your head around it even as people kill ancient trees. The Appalachians are like older than air or something. I don't even know. They're old as shit. They're some of the oldest mountains in the world, right? And the fact that people were clear cutting the mountain, like blowing up the mountain, was just too much. I couldn't wrap my head around it. And so I just didn't think about it. And I think that overall, that's what people do with climate change. There's big, major things that are happening that are really big. And like, I'm not trying to say that other crises that are happening aren't really big. Climate change is the mother of all crises.
Yeah.
You know, it is the most existential threat to all life on Earth that has existed since there was sentient life. And I'm not just including humans in that, you know? And so people don't want to think about it. And I think that makes sense. And I think that the people who put in the work to be like, hey, come to Mountain Justice Summer Camp or Spring Break Camp or whatever, and made these spaces where people could show up and learn about what was happening and get engaged. I think that maybe climate change, it's the have people show up and give them something to do or tell them that work needs doing and that they can figure out what to do, you know? But we kind of as a movement a little bit too much are like, I don't know, just figure it out. Because then the current people who are like making, there's actually some people doing amazing work. There's a lot of people fighting pipelines and there's people fighting extraction. And I'm not even like mad at the people who like throw food at paintings or whatever, but it's not something that invites a lot of people in from my perspective. I try not to talk shit on tactics. I try to like, be like, I try to do the more stuff model of critique, where instead of talking shit on their tactic, I should do a different tactic. And what am I doing? I mean, whatever. I'm running around trying to help people get prepared. I actually think I'm doing a lot. But anyway, I just got excited.
I think that,
I realize it goes full circle to what you're saying.
That thing, I mean, it's like, I think a lot about how the Young Lords said, you know, who are, they're fighting for Puerto Rican liberation, 1970s, modeled themselves after the Black, after the Black Panthers. And they said in their early texts, you know, like that they believed that their own people, seeing their people fight in the streets with the cops, would radicalize people. So that, like, having escalated tactics, and this is similar to the Ireland story you told, like escalated tactics, confrontational tactics, you know, liberals tell us we're going to alienate people. What did you say?
Setting fire to trash on the streets. I really like the Young Lords.
Like, escalated tactics don't alienate people. They bring a lot of people in, and the people who think they're alienated from them might like feel scared of them and stuff, but the cultural shift and change that they produce still brings those people along. In the end, they want to be like, oh, no, no, I'm not racist. Oh, no, no, whatever. You know, like, it's like it moves the needle. And so I think we need escalated tactics, and we need invitations and inroads. And for a long time, I've said, I think mutual aid is one of the best on-ramps, and historically has been one of the best on-ramps to movements. Like, most people get involved in movements through like trying to immediately help somebody, you know, because that's what, when you're fired up, that's what you want, or because they got help through a mutual aid project of some kind. And that's what politicized them. They're like, who are these people who are giving away this thing that I need where I can't get it anywhere else, you know, and who are not mean to me and who tell me it's not my fault and that actually the system's fucked. Huh? What are they saying? They're right. You know? So that, that I believe deeply in the mutual aid on-ramp. I also think that like moments like riots and stuff can be an on-ramp where people are like, I'm joining in and now I'm burning up cop port car, and like the, feeling that kind of power. And then like, I want to learn more about who these people were, who I met in the streets, whatever. And for some people, the on-ramp is that they first encounter. I mean, I have a friend who's a really incredible anarchist organizer who does like really massive mutual aid projects and is just so brilliant, and told me that they first were like, they joined the Bernie campaign and like, and then like, were really involved in the Bernie Sanders campaign. And then we're like, wait, I don't know if this is really working, you know, but like everyone comes in somehow, you know? And so part of it too, is that we should be in all those places, trying to encourage people to learn more about like movement history or, you know, horizontal tactics or, bold tactics that are, I just went to an amazing event at a, anarchist space in Seattle called Pipsqueak. The event was surrounding, they had collected all these accounts of kind of like sabotage and vandalisms and shutdown type of actions related to opposing the genocide in Gaza. So many stories I hadn't heard. You know, they collected this huge amount. They had this really wonderful hour of like, you could come and read this zine they'd printed out with all this stuff and think it through. And then a really, really well facilitated discussion for an hour and a half. And it was like, that's like that, like making sure people can find out about the rad stuff that's happening. Like, that's not going to be reported. Yeah. It's like, that's so cool. And also then people got to discuss all their dilemmas about tactics. Like, oh my gosh, I've been going to all these kind of more, you know, media spectacle events about Gaza. I've thought these things about that. What's it like to learn about these other things people are doing? You know, like just people get to have those juicy conversations about like what they think about the tactics they are considering. Yeah.
I love it. And we talked about twice as long as we thought we were going to. And now this is two episodes. So you all listening had to wait an extra week to hear the other half of the conversation. Do you have any kind of last thoughts on preparedness, mutual aid, how your thinking has shifted, all the topics that we've been talking about today?
Well, the thing that's spurred us having this conversation was that I wrote that piece for In These Times that was about my experience of reading two sci-fi, cli-fi novels. One is Ministry of the Future and one was The Deluge. And I encourage people to read that piece if you want to hear my thoughts on those books. But one of the things that happened from reading those books and then writing about why I, what I thought was a failure of different aspects of those books was how now, I just think about this because you are an amazing fiction writer, like how part of what happens to me now when I read almost any speculative book, any book that's fiction that takes place somewhat in the future, is I am like, it feels instantly conservative because it never includes collapse, right? Because inevitably they've got us 50 years ahead and there's some AI, or even if there's been some disruption from climate stuff, like it's never as bad as it actually is. And that is fascinating to me. You know, it's like, oh, and they always have all this intense tech development in such books in ways that I'm like, I really recommend people actually listen to Kelly Hayes' podcast episodes about AI. Really, really okay. useful for me in trying to understand the kind of the hubris of the tech sector in the way they talk about AI and the way they're making people afraid of or hopeful about AI and how off base it is and kind of what the deal really is. But anyway, now I've historically found speculative fiction to be a vital place for trying to help myself think about crisis and collapse. And also now I feel so strongly because I think I may mention this to you once. I've been very moved by this person, Jem Bendel, who's like this, in many ways, he does not share all of our values and is coming from a very different place, but he's like this academic kind of whistleblower about how bad climate stuff really is. And I find myself go into my own denial about what's happening and retreat from what I know. And then I listen to the introduction to his book, Breaking Together, again, to remind myself about the stakes of what I'm living through. And I feel like in some ways I used to use, and I still somewhat use speculative fiction in that way, but I'm just increasingly just like, even most speculative fiction is telling us the wrong message about how long the systems we live under are going to last and how much they're going to flourish with new technologies that I just don't think is real.
You know, what's funny is some of this, a little bit of it, is baked into a problem of writing fiction where I've actually gotten not in trouble with, but I've had editors take out dates in my writing before, right? Because I'll write a short story about a like sort of collapsey world or whatever, and I'll be like, after 2022, when the, you know, I wrote this in like 2018 or whatever, because I was trying to write on a realistic timeline where I was like, oh, the world's not going to be the same in 2022. And I feel like I was pretty accurate about that, right? But they have to future-proof their magazine, right? And so, you know, you don't want to make certain types of claims about the next 3 years because you want your story to have a shelf life of that long. And so some of it is like baked in as a problem in publishing and in science fiction writing. And that said, I think most people... Do you ever read that book, Desert, the like... Green Nihilist book about
I've read like half of it.
Is real. I haven't read it in a long time. I remember reading it and being like, well, this is naively optimistic.
That's the one where they're like 7/8 of people are gonna die. Like,
I can't even remember exactly, but
it was intense.
It was like climate change isn't gonna be stopped and we have to like readdress how things work on a fundamental level. And because where I've been at, I don't know. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm with you on like when I read stuff about the future where it's like, and then it'll all work. I actually still really like the Ministry for the Future, and maybe actually I should have you on just specifically to talk about Ministry of the Future at a different point. Because it's a complicated, it's a caveated, I like this book, you know?
That's like about Deluge. It's like, I liked Deluge, even though I think it still has the same problem. Yeah.
But I haven't read Deluge yet.
I think it's really worth reading. I think it's way better character development than Ministry.
There's no character development in Ministry.
Oh God, Ministry is so dry.
Kim Stanley Robinson does not write people. Kim Stanley Robinson writes ecosystems.
Yeah, and Deluge really ropes in a lot more of like rising fascism with climate crisis, and has characters that are more different class, race, gender than Ministry, is just like. It's way more compelling unfolding, even though in the end it still imagines that like states will turn around and like fix things.
Yeah. Well, I think there's plenty more we could talk about, and I hope we get to talk about it soon at some point. But in the meantime, how can people find you or your work, or what would you like people to, or if you want to shout out any specific projects that you want to like draw attention towards, whether they're yours or other people's?
Mostly everything I do, I put on, I mean, I'm kind of bad at it, but I'll put a lot of things at deanspade.net, which is just like a website where I collect like the things I write and the videos and the many things. So it's cool. A pretty good source for the backlog.
If people want to read the specific article that we've been talking about, if you just, it's called Climate Disaster is Here and the State Will Never Save Us. But also if you type in, the way I found it just now when I was trying to come up with the title, I just typed in Dean Spade, Kim Stanley Robinson personally, and it came up, you know. But okay.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then you should run around screaming that the sky is falling. No, don't do that. You should make bug out bags for your friends or do whatever you want. You should think about whatever. We already told you what we think. But you can also support this show. And if you want to support this show, you can do so by telling people about it. And you can support this show by supporting us financially on Patreon. Do not feel obliged to do it. This is a free show. However, we're incredibly grateful because people's donations are how we manage to pay our transcriptionist, which is very important to us that the show is transcribed, and then also our audio engineer. And one day, I keep promising this, but we don't know when this day will come. One day, it'll pay the hosts or the guests. But for now, it doesn't. And that's okay because, you know, the world works the way it works. You can support us on Patreon by supporting our publisher, which is Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness at patreon.com/strangersinatangledwilderness. And in particular, we would like to thank Ephemeral. Ooh, there's new names on here. That's really exciting. Ephemeral, Appalachian Liberation Library. And they wanted to specifically point, I would never make this, but they specifically pointed out it's Appalachian, not Appalachian. That's in the description of how we're going to read this. Portland's Hedron Hackerspace, Boldfield, E, Patuli, Eric, Buck, Julia, Catgut, Marm, Carson, Lord Harkin, Trickster, Princess Miranda, Ben Ben, Anonymous, Funder, Janice Nodell, Allie, Papa Runa, Milica, Boise Mutual Aid, Theo, Hunter, SJ Page, Nicole, David, Dana, Chelsea, Starro, Jennifer, Kirk, Chris, Micaiah, and as always, the immortal Haas the dog. And when you support this Strangers in Tangled Wilderness, you're supporting this show. You're also supporting a show called The Spectacle. We renamed Anarcho Geek Power Hour to The Spectacle. And you're also supporting the podcast called Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness and a whole bunch of other projects. So that's that thing where I do the outro. And I hope you all are doing as well as you can. And we'll talk to you soon.